You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 19, and this is a special episode for two reasons. This is, I think, the seventh attempt to record the damn thing, and my guest today is Dr. Jeremy Swiss of Grand Valley State University, who has been kind enough to fly all the way over from the States to join me here in my living room. Jeremy, welcome to England and the podcast.
Great to be here. I'm here for the fourth year in a row presenting at the Leeds Medieval Congress, just up the road, so I'm happy to come down and do this in person.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to have you here, especially after all the failed attempts. Yeah, so Jeremy, today we're going to learn about a Roman emperor that I have to admit I'd never heard of until I read your blog. But as you have identified, he may have displayed neurodivergent traits during his lifetime. And this would be the 4th century Emperor Julian?
That's right.
Great. I'm super excited to discuss a Roman emperor on this podcast. But before we dive into that, I'd love to hear about your experience as a neurodivergent archaeologist and your specific areas of interest. Jeremy, how old were you when you realised you were part of the ADHD family, and how did neurodiversity play out for you? Because I know I struggled academically, and in awe of you for scaling Mount Academia.
Yes, I was diagnosed probably earlier than I can remember. I was one of those hyperactive children from a very early age. I think in elementary school, second or third or fourth grade is when I was, I think, officially diagnosed. My parents were noticing I had behavioral problems in school. I was disruptive, not getting along with the other kids, and was just acting out, not showing my teachers the proper respect and all those sorts of things. And I was seeing therapists and psychiatrists and everything. And they made the diagnosis, and I went through various pharmaceutical regimens, the traditional Ritalin and a couple other things. And I was on that medication through, I think, being at a high school. And then I think by high school, my behavior problems seemed to have gotten under control just for whatever reason. But it actually wasn't until I was already in grad school that actually went back onto the medication, because I think by then I was having some other problems with anxiety and depression. And it was determined that actually the ADHD was probably a factor in some of those things as well. And so I'm currently on ADHD medication again, along with antidepressants, and went through some other things. And so it's helping a bit, but of course the symptoms are still there. But when I was in school growing up, I was the kind of person who was sent to the principal's office or kept after school suspension type of thing, just because I didn't know how. I was very impulsive, talked out of turn, had said, I just look at my report card, makes inappropriate comments, talks without being called upon, and all that sort of hyperactivity that, you know, made me very few friends. But ultimately, it wasn't until the past few years that I came to understand that this is how I'm wired, rather than some sort of medical disorder that needs to be done away with, and that there can be some advantages to embracing this. But
oh, absolutely, embracing your neurodiversity. Absolutely. I mean, the symptoms ain't going to go away because they're who you are, man. Mm-hmm. That's especially the impulsivity and things like that. On your school reports, did you also get? Was it displays great potential? If only they could focus.
Yes. Yeah. I think the subjects that I had particular interest in, such as history, languages, social studies, geography, the stuff that all works well for becoming a classicist, were ones that I certainly had better focus in, just because I found the topics inherently interesting. I think a thing with ADHD is that you lack focus, but you can also hyper-focus. Yeah. And those are the things that I was more prone to hyper-focus on, whereas the subjects such as mainly math or anything that had math in it was the ones where there was just no sort of stimulus to keep my attention. And so I did less well in those subjects. Yeah. And I still do.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but maths is something I'm terrible at. I'm not wired for. And I think it's either dyscalculia or dyscalculia, but I believe I've got that. I don't have a diagnosis for it. So it happens with numbers when I get, I can do basic 5 plus 5 really easy, but when it gets more complicated, something happens. I get so far through trying to answer the question, and it's like the world just falls away under me and I spin.
It, for me, at least, it may have something to do with that I'm a very visual learner. I conceive of a lot of things in terms of visuals, which is why I really like working with maps. When I took chemistry in high school, I had the periodic table down and things like that, because that was a visual representation of things. But as soon as I had to do balancing equations and all the math and anything that requires abstract thinking, suddenly it just went over my head. Or like geometry. I was good at geometry. Okay, but so the more that I can put a mental picture onto things, like even when I'm thinking about history and like dates, I'm always visualizing a timeline and plugging in different things along it that are in relation to each other. I don't know if that's part of ADHD thinking, but it's certainly how I'm wired, which sort of, I think, helps with determine my academic trajectory, perhaps.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've always struggled with the ADHD, the BC, E, and then an AD, and it being there a century ahead of itself. That I've always, whenever I try to locate something like an ancient battle or a culture, I have to go through a process of finding it. I can't just leave it there. It doesn't work.
Yeah. So like with numbers, if I'll see a number that is especially like 3 digits or even 4 digits, like the first thing that will come to my mind is what happened during that date or what was going on in whatever part of the world at that date. And suddenly it has meaning to me.
Yeah. That makes sense. That's fair. Yeah. So when did you get into archaeology?
I've never actually picked up a trowel to do archaeology like a lot of my great colleagues. I have a lot of respect for those who will go out in the summer heat, especially in the Mediterranean in these days of global warming, to get down and dirty with that stuff. But I actually regret not doing a summer study abroad or just an opportunity to get in the field to see what they do. And they do a lot of important work that is essential for what I do as a classicist who mainly is studying literature and how that literature fits into the broader political, intellectual, cultural history, certainly in relation to a lot of the material context that the archaeologists are elucidating for us. But definitely a lot of my work can be conducted from from the comfort of a chair with a computer and library access.
Yeah, I mean, there's time yet, Jeremy. I'm sure you could end up on a dig or two quite easily.
Perhaps.
Yeah, one day maybe. One day. Maybe not the Mediterranean in the middle of the summer, though.
With late antiquity, there's definitely things further north, including here in England.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that'll keep you cool.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic, Jeremy. What is your position at the university?
So I was a visiting assistant professor at Grand Valley State University outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I have left that job. And as of next month, as of next month, I will be starting as an assistant professor in the Department of Romance and Classical Studies at Michigan State University, which is about an hour and a half drive into the middle of the state from where I was. So it's a nice big step up and to a department with some wonderful colleagues, and I hope to be there for a while.
Exciting.
Yeah.
That's great. Congratulations on the position.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on the book. That's coming out. Did you say it was coming out in September?
Yes. September 26th, I believe, is the publication date, the print publication date for my first academic monograph titled Julian Augustus, Platonism, Myth, and the Refounding of Rome, and coming out with Oxford University Press in the Oxford Studies in Late Antiquity series. And September 26th is at least the North American publication date. The estimated UK publication date, unfortunately, won't be until December. Okay, but keep looking for that. I think you'll put a link from the OUP website onto show notes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll stick that on there. So if anybody wants to locate Jeremy's book, indeed the blog it's not in the book as a chapter or anything, but there's elements of that in the book, isn't there?
Yep.
I tell you what, then, that is an excellent opportunity to segue into ancient Rome. We're just going to have a very quick break. And yes, when we come back, Jeremy's going to talk to us about Emperor Julian. And probably after that, we'll start looking at what neurodivergent traits he may or may not have displayed. Okay, Jeremy, as I said earlier, as I admitted earlier, I hadn't heard of Emperor Julian. Could you put us in context, or put Julian in context for us and give us a background to him?
Yes, the Roman Emperor Julian is not usually a household name unless you have an interest in Roman history, maybe took a Roman history class in university. And that's the case for most Roman emperors, especially in the later Roman Empire, in which Julian had reigned from the years 361 to 363 as a sole emperor, though he had a junior emperor status for a few years before that, because this was a time when we actually had multiple emperors ruling the empire at once in senior and junior positions. And so from 355 to 361, he was, or to 360, technically, he was under his cousin, Constantius II, who was the senior emperor. And Constantius II was the son of an emperor that more people have heard of, especially here in England, in places like York, namely Constantine. The first Christian Roman emperor, the one who adopted Christianity and put the empire on its way toward conversion to Christianity at the expense of traditional Greco-Roman paganism. What Julian was the son of Constantine's half-brother, and therefore he was the nephew of Constantine and a part of his dynasty, and therefore Constantius II was his cousin. And when Julian came to the throne, he decided, because of various educational and spiritual experiences he had in his upbringing and his young adulthood, that he actually was not Christian. He came out of the closet once he became sole emperor and it was safe to do, and said, wait a minute, I'm not actually a Christian. I have converted to philosophy, technically, and with his kind of interest in spiritual conversion to Neoplatonic philosophy, this very kind of spiritual and otherworldly type of ethical and theological doctrines that he was very much interested in during his young adulthood. He also, by extension, embraced the traditional gods of ancient Greece and Rome, the gods of the Roman state, as well as those worshipped by Plato and many pagan Greek philosophers at the time.
How interesting. Yeah. So how long was Rome? Because this is potential. If Julian had gotten away with it and Rome had continued along the pagan route again, how long would the empire actually been Christian for, from Constantine to Julian? Obviously not long.
What is very fascinating about the fourth century when it comes to the religious question is it's not an overnight thing. Just because Constantine converts to Christianity doesn't mean the empire becomes Christian overnight. When he becomes Christian around after the Battle of Milvian Bridge in 312 CE, only about maybe 10% of the empire is Christian. And so when he converts, it's not like everybody suddenly just falls in line. Okay. Rather, over the course of his reign, which was a few decades, as well as the reign of his sons, especially Constantius II, which was a few more decades, we're talking almost half a century, so we have slow conversion, especially among the upper classes, because at the time we basically have a phenomenon in which the people at the very top, the emperors and the royal family, are Christian, and becoming Christian becomes a convenient way to access power. Right. Especially if or even become a member of the church as a bishop because the church is being subsidized suddenly by the state. Yeah. Right. And so what we have over that period of nearly a half a century is a lot of conversions to Christianity among especially the upper classes, people in cities where Christianity traditionally was doing well. However, by the early 360s, when Julian comes to the throne, the empire is still not majority Christian. OK, so it is not a fait accompli.
No.
And so Julian still has a lot of support for basically diverting the resources of the Roman state back into the traditional priesthoods and temples and cults of the traditional gods away from the church. And suddenly it becomes the reverse phenomenon where suddenly to access power and privilege, now you had to align yourself more with traditional paganism. And I think, and I'm not the only scholar who thinks so, that if Julian did have a long reign and had as much time as Constantine and his sons, then we would have seen a significant rate of reconversion to back to paganism.
So it would have been the pagan Roman Empire, not the Holy Roman Empire.
At least for a while longer.
Yeah.
Okay. That's getting into speculative history, which is not history, but, you know, the data that we have is that the trend of reconversion under the only 20 months that he reigned among in people of the army, people in the upper administration, even members of the church, was significant. And so what he lacked was time, because he died in battle against Persia in June of 363. And he happened to be succeeded by Christian emperors who basically went back to the Constantinian kind of program.
Well, that is fascinating stuff, Jeremy. So Emperor Julian, you in your blog, you talk in detail about some of the neurodivergent qualities. I'm not calling them traits anymore. They're qualities. I'm upgrading them. Would you mind? Do you want to talk about the blog, or do you want to go into Julian from a different angle of just identifying what neurodivergent traits you thought you saw?
As I say in the blog post, which I did for the website Asterion, which was a website that advocated for neurodivergence scholars within the field of classical studies and related disciplines, and recognizing that a significant number of us do have various types of neurodivergence, and that this is not a bad thing, right? And that this is, and that here is a space where we can discuss our experience doing this kind of scholarship, being in this sort of scholarly community, while also being wired this way. And there's quite a few of us, especially with ADHD, as well as folks on the autism spectrum, et cetera. And so when I saw this website and there was an opportunity to write something, I was also in the early stages of writing my book. And the book was about largely how Julian writes about himself, but also in later chapters, how other people write about him and how we need to keep those sources separate in order to get a best idea, at least, of how Julian presents himself, and not let the other sources, by both people who were his fans as well as his detractors, distort our idea of Julian's own self-representation. And so what I found particularly fascinating with regard to the ADHD angle was not actually what he wrote about himself, because of course when you write about yourself, you're going to try to make yourself look good.
Yeah.
And you're going to probably downplay some things that are perhaps more inconvenient or embarrassing. I think Julian is pretty humble in the way he presents himself, but I think what resonated with me was actually how some of his critics talk about him. And why it resonated with me is because this sounded like someone who was criticizing someone for exhibiting what I thought was typical behaviors of a student class with ADHD,
right?
Especially the hyperactive traits, the impulsivity, etc. And so what I'm talking about is specifically the invective written by the Greek theologian Gregory of Nazianzus, okay, one of the most prolific and revered writers in Greek Orthodoxy and Byzantium after the Bible itself. And shortly in the few years after Julian died, he wrote a couple of invectives, okay, two pieces of basically the oratory of blame, really trying to denigrate Julian because Julian was such a threat to the ascendancy of Christianity and the power of the church and its alignment with the state, that Gregory was basically trying his best to take control of the narrative and show that this guy was everything that you could possibly think of in terms of the qualities of a bad emperor. And so his opposition to Christianity corresponded to also having naturally evil qualities that makes one unfit to rule.
Yeah.
And Gregory had an advantage in this because Gregory was a great orator and he studied rhetoric, the pagan classics, how to make a good speech, to be a great writer, to be very persuasive, right? Which helped him as a bishop and theologian, of course, but Julian did as well. Okay. Whether you were pagan or Christian or otherwise Jewish, if you were highly educated and you wanted to access power and have a public life in the later Roman Empire, you learned the the classical texts. You studied them, learned read poetry, literature, how to interpret them. You learned the mythology. And then you studied rhetoric, how to construct various speeches, write various forms of literature. And so Julian did too. Julian wrote all sorts of speeches and different types of literature. He combined, he experimented. And this is what I really like to look at in terms of Julian. And so Julian presents himself through a lot of these writings in a way that is trying to influence kind of his agenda. And so Gregory is doing the same. And Gregory and Julian were actually in the same rhetoric classes together in Athens briefly for about a month or two during the summer of the year 355, shortly before Julian was called to become this junior emperor under his cousin Constantius.
So he would have been probably already, do you think that there would have been a bit of friction there already because Julian had already made his, well, was already experiencing what he'd experienced to field it, who was a pagan rather than a Christian?
Yes, this would have been a time when Julian had probably already from Christianity, quote unquote, right, and converted to paganism and studied pagan Neoplatonic philosophy, but he was also still in the closet while he was studying rhetoric alongside Gregory, as well as Basil of Caesarea, possibly under the Greek pagan rhetorician Himerius in Athens. And so Gregory has this passage from one of his invectives, the second one, Oration 5, against Julian, where he describes Julian as a student in the rhetoric classroom. And basically what Gregory's doing here is he's trying to say, I saw this guy early on, and I could predict what kind of person he would be later, namely a bad ruler, a tyrant, based on these physical and behavioral traits that he exhibited in the classroom. And what they were was that he was very restless. His eyes were darting back and forth. He had unsteady breathing. He couldn't sit still. He was very talkative. He was disruptive. He made inappropriate comments. He was not really in with the rhythm of the lesson of the teacher. And so Gregory says, okay, so I saw this. And so it made perfect sense that he would become someone who was very excitable, someone who was very capricious, someone who was not able to really regulate and control themselves. And this is the rhetoric of invective partly, because the point of invective, especially against a ruler, is to show that they physically, behaviorally are not fit to rule. If they cannot rule themselves, they are not fit to rule others. And the words that in Greek that Gregory specifically uses that really resonated with me in terms of ADHD is anomalia and ekstasis. Okay. So anomalia is a, which means not, and then it comes from nomos, which means rule or law or regulation. So it's irregularity. Okay. It is the failure to be able to regulate your behavior, okay, your desires, to practice moderation, to have self-control, which is one of the cardinal virtues, is sophrosune, self-control, continentia in Latin. Okay, right. That is a virtue that a good ruler should have.
It's very stoic.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And then ekstasis is the other side of the coin, where it's literally standing outside oneself, a failure to be grounded, okay, to have presence, to focus, to have keeping yourself in the moment without letting any sort of distractions or whims draw you away from that, because that causes you to stand ekhistemi, right, out of yourself.
Yes. Okay.
We actually get the word ecstasy from this as well, because that causes you to step out of your own personality.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Many out-of-body experiences on a daily basis. I was just thinking, as you were reading what Gregory had been saying, I thought, based on school reports, you and I would also be terrible Roman emperors.
Exactly. Yeah, I could just imagine the list of people I would prescribe for just very trivial things that annoyed me on airplanes and things like that. But I probably should say no more about that.
Lower yourself, Jared.
Yeah.
It was another very quick break, and then we're going to come back with some more. And yeah, so welcome back. And in the last section, we were talking about what Gregory had been saying about Emperor Julian. And to me, as a non-academic, that's some pretty, I want to say, good evidence, even though it's not. But the signs for neurodiversity, I think, are there. But Julian, what are your thoughts on that?
So again, this passage resonated with me because I saw a lot of the familiar traits. Again, this sounds like something that I would see on a middle school report card. However, there's a lot of caveats here because, one, this is a rhetorical construction, right? This has the agenda specifically of denigrating this person, of making this person look unfit to be a good ruler, right? And so it is necessarily exaggerated, and it is conforming to various character types prescribed by the rhetorical genre of invective in order to persuade the audience that this person was no good even from the start.
Yeah.
And so it aligns Christianity and paganism in opposite camps of good and evil and naturally, things like that. So we can't necessarily take Gregory at his word for being an accurate witness to whatever he witnessed. The other thing is that even if Gregory is interpreting what he saw in a very ungenerous way, in an unsympathetic way, the problem with using ancient evidence for mental disorders or mental states or conditions, and let alone kind of physical ailments, is that these are socially constructed descriptions, right? How even ancient medicine is presenting health and disease, okay, these is a product of the time and place. And it becomes difficult to make what's called retrospective diagnoses. Can we retrospectively diagnose a Roman emperor based on these highly rhetorically and socially constructed accounts that interpret his behavior, especially when those accounts are not by people who are medically trained, certainly not medically trained in the modern sense.
Of course, yeah.
So that is a big caveat, which is why I hesitate to make any such diagnoses. I still find it plausible that Julian may have exhibited some of these traits and may have been wired similarly to what we would diagnose as ADHD. However, I'm not going to push the issue, but what I can admit is that yes, there was neurodiversity back then, 100%. Okay, anthropologically speaking, right?
Yeah.
So it's plausible, but again, I'm not going to push it. Nevertheless, the fact that it resonates with me personally is why I is still worth doing, because this helps me understand myself with some perspective, and again, might be illuminating in how we understand Julian as well. So you want me to talk about the other major piece of evidence for this?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yes.
Gregory was not the only witness to this behavior. We also have the historian Ammianus Marcellinus, who was a contemporary of Julian. He served under Julian for some of his campaigns. So he was a soldier, and then he later became a gentleman historian in Rome. And he was much more sympathetic to Julian. Okay. He was not Libanius or Himerius. He wasn't one of these rhetoricians who was a propagandist who was trying to make Julian look like the best thing ever. He's going to save the world and everything. However, he does present him a lot more sympathetically than I think a lot of people during his day, which was a few decades after Julian's reign. And so he was trying to rehabilitate his reputation, say, hey, this guy was a patriot. He was a good Roman who did his best for the empire. He had a lot of the great virtues of a good general, of a good leader, of a good emperor. But he also had some flaws. He was a tragic hero, and he eventually succumbed to those flaws. And so we can learn lessons from his example, right? And so this is what he's trying to do. And therefore he has, you know, a somewhat balanced account, which we still have to be skeptical of, but nevertheless, he certainly is trying to be more fair and balanced than Gregory. So he also describes Julian exhibiting some of these traits. For instance, he describes him physically with sort of these darting eyes. His eyes are aglow. He is someone who has a lot of energy, takes a lot of initiative. And so you can see this is a much more charitable reading of what Gregory is seeing as a negative quality of restlessness, impulsivity. But nevertheless, Ammianus also talks about how Julian has this thing called levitas, okay, which can be translated as levity, but it really means kind of capriciousness. It's the opposite of gravitas. Gravitas, weightiness, dignity, seriousness,
yes,
being grounded,
yeah,
being deliberate. Whereas levitas, that's not heaviness, that's lightness. That's the ability to be just pushed and blown away in the wind, kind of taken which way, wherever your whims and impulses and then whatever stimulus takes you. And he describes how Julian is liable to that. There's an episode in which his mentor, the philosopher Maximus, shows up in Constantinople while Julian is hearing cases in the Senate. Okay. Right. And he hears somebody whispers in his ear, says, "Hey, Maximus is here." And then Julian, without a thought, because he's been sitting there all day. Okay. Imagine having an ADHD and having to sit on a judge's bench, everybody looking at you all day. And then suddenly says, "Hey, one of your favorite people's here." He just jumps up and then rushes out of the room, brings Maximus in front of all the senators and in a display of affected humility. And Ammianus calls him out for this as saying, "Oh, he's just seeking empty praise for, you know, this affected humility in deference to this philosopher, even though he is an emperor, he should have more dignity and gravitas," right? So that's one thing Ammianus says about his levitas. However, what Ammianus also talks about is how Julian is conscious of this, and that Julian himself recognizes, he does not deny that he has these impulses, that he is liable to do things without thinking, say things, do things, and that he says that Julian has a way to counter this. Rather than trying to discipline himself and try to work on changing his nature from within, he actually has advisors around him who have permission, this quality of paresia, of being able to speak with him frankly, even though he's emperor, to basically call him out, to basically say, "Are you sure you want to do that? Or I'm not sure if that's a great idea. You sure you want to take that back?" And he wants to keep these people around him to keep him in check so that he doesn't do anything reckless.
That's fantastic management. Well done.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah. And I read that as saying Julian recognizes that he's not necessarily able to control himself all the time. So he has these external sort of things in order to help regulate his behavior. And that certainly resonates with me because I'm also someone who has to have these things to really keep me grounded, like my partner and things like that.
Yeah, I married my helper.
Yes.
Yeah, I think rather than medication, I think we had a team of specialists around us would be fine, wouldn't we?
Yeah, and I think the medication I would count as also an external thing.
Yeah,
the medication is the thing that helps rather than any sort of, I don't respond well to like meditation practices, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, all that stuff just never worked with me.
No.
I couldn't keep it. But I did have various psychiatric treatments with electromagnetism and various pharmaceuticals that eventually helped, not just for my ADHD, but also my depressive episodes, anxiety, and things like that. And so I think there's something to be said for that.
Oh, absolutely there is. Yeah, that's fantastic, Jeremy. So Julian, is there anything else you'd like to add in terms of who he was and what he went through, according to the sources, and neurodiversity in general?
What I think an important kind of so what for looking at Julian through this angle of his potential neurodiversity, ADHD-ness, ADHD-itas, if you want to turn into a Roman virtue and everything, is how this helps make sense of his inclinations when it comes to philosophy, religion, and spirituality. And I think this also relates to the idea of having a lack of ability to focus on the abstract and needing a lot of external factors to keep one in check. So, for instance, Julian has a reputation as an ascetic, right? And you're thinking, if he's an ascetic, how does that relate? In my own experience, right, having ADHD means that it's more difficult for us to practice moderation, right? The virtue of self-control, but also not going to extremes. And when we think of immoderation, we think of extremes of indulgence, right? Extremes of indulgence in carnal pleasures and gambling, alcohol, things like that. That's why people with ADHD are statistically more liable to have those sorts of addictions and things like that and things. But it could also be extremes of defect, right? Of not doing things, right? And that's asceticism, complete self-denial, right? And at least in my experience, I counter my potential liability to overindulge with asceticism. Like, I don't drink alcohol. I've been sober for about 4 or 5 years. Okay. I don't eat between meals. I basically have to just cut off things yeah. that I am liable to overindulge in, because it's very difficult for me to find that happy golden mean, as it were. And I feel that Julian, perhaps that makes sense of himself as well in his asceticism, right? His inability or less ability to practice moderation means that he's more likely to just forego things in general. And this also makes sense of his particular kind of inclinations philosophically, because he followed not just any brand of Neoplatonism, because actually by the fourth century, there was actually different kind of focuses you could and tendencies within Neoplatonism. Originally, Neoplatonism, with the philosopher Plotinus and Porphyry from the third century, was very much about spiritual discipline, turning inward, and deep concentration and contemplation of the God within us, right? Of keeping ourselves focused on the ideal world, the mind of God, you know, and trying to become an entirely rational being and identify with that rational part of our soul, and which is equal to the divinity, and uniting with that divinity, right? Julian, on the other hand, is much more inclined to the Neoplatonism of a possible student of Porphyry named Iamblichus, who was operating at the end of the third century, early fourth century. In fact, Julian was taught by students of Iamblichus, so he's in that tradition. And Iamblichus, while he was very much in favor of mental, moral discipline, ethics, and some of the more conventional practices of philosophy, he was also interested in theurgy and how philosophy, Platonic philosophy, and traditional religion are related and are actually one. And he believes that you cannot achieve any sort of mystical connection with the gods, or even unification with the gods, and access to the gods' grace and blessings, unless you also practice traditional religious rituals that have been communicated through prophecy and divination and revelation ages ago to the original theurgists, people like Numa Pompilius and Abraham and Solon and Lycurgus, right? Through things like the Delphic Oracle, right, et cetera, who prescribe these original spiritual practices that allow us to tune into the gods' wavelength. And so I believe that Julian is more inclined to this type of kind of philosophy of salvation, because it prescribes a set of rituals and practices and sort of external things that facilitate not just one's personal salvation, but also the preservation of the cosmos, versus having to rely on your own sort of spiritual discipline. And I think this also corresponds to how Julian was kind of overzealous as a zealous convert to pagan religion. He went to excess in sacrifice and performing these rituals, because he believed that the more you perform these rituals, of course, the better for everybody. And so that's just another symptom of his immoderation.
Yeah.
But I believe that that's why he went in on the more kind of religious ritual centric branch of Neoplatonism than the more kind of theoretical contemplative type.
Sure. I know we were comparing, we're not diagnosing and so on, but just from that, how many, if you just go on social media, how many neurodivergent influencers are declaring this particular affirmation or meditation or sunlight or all these things as part of your daily routine?
Yeah.
And it's similar, isn't it? That right. Just grounding yourself and then being in touch with yourself and that whole thing of you are the universe experiencing itself.
Yes, exactly. And I believe that Julian needed more structure to be able to get into that sort of headspace. And he found that in traditional religious practices.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, then, Joey, I'm going to put you on the spot. Obviously, it's not an academic endeavor, this. It's purely spectacle and fun. Based on what you understand in your academic research on Emperor Julian, on a scale of 1 to 10, how neurodivergent do you think he was?
That is, it's funny because we spent this whole podcast showing how Julian seems to have exhibited traits, or just I am reading into him things that I personally identify with. However, again, I am still hesitant to retrospectively diagnose and things like that. Because he also had PTSD. right?
Yeah, sure.
A lot of trauma, childhood trauma from the fact that most of his family was murdered when he was like six or seven years old.
Oh.
And that explains perhaps a lot of sort of his later trajectory in life, his rejection of Christianity, identified with his cousins and his uncle, which were implicated in a lot of this sort of family, royal family drama. And anyone who is the product of these sort of imperial families is not going to be, how would I say it, a conventional person.
Yeah,
right? Sure. Especially that many centuries ago, where we really have a very little idea of what the baseline is for what might be neurotypical.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I think it's plausible given what he was able to accomplish in such a short amount of time. I think he was that sort of restlessness, that sort of impatience, that sort of pursuit of glory, right?
Yeah.
On the one hand, there was a lot of kind of traditional cultural factors that would motivate that. But on the other hand, I feel that he was someone who there was definitely the way he was wired, I don't think was typical of a lot of people of his day. And I'm not going to say he was definitely not one of a kind, but at least for me, he was, if anybody had to be ADHD in ancient history, he was definitely someone I would think about first. Yeah.
Yeah, great. And I wonder what he would have done with 20 or 30 years to rule. Yeah, Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on ADHD BC. It's been so interesting. And if you're not too busy, I'd now like to take you to an old English pub down the road and buy you a pint.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
Great. Well, thanks for listening. And I hope you can join us next time for another journey into the fascinating world of ancient neurodiversity. Bye.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy, our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht, and our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.